But they liked that electric bass. Yeah. The bass player was passed out drunk in the back at the prom. That was a good show.
You know, recalling back, we never did Jerry Lee Lewis, did we?
I don't think
we
so.
We did a whole lot of shaking.
Did we?
If we had to.
Yeah, if too many requests came in, we'd do a whole lot.
That's like
of
Wipeout. We'd do it if we had to.
Yeah. Shake. And the same with the Beatles stuff.
Yeah.
We would do Wipeout as a joke.
Kinda, yeah.
And I don't think we ever played the whole song.
Maybe we didn't.
We'd play a couple bars and we just go, that's enough.
We did some Beatles stuff.
I saw her standing there in that because it was close to Chuck Berry.
We did a few Beatles songs, but
not a lot of it.
We did covers of their
songs.
Covers.
They got to be too complicated.
Yeah. I remember doing, is it called And I Love Her? Remember that one? We did that.
Yes.
One.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That was a pretty song. Yeah.
How about the Rolling Stones? Did you cover any of their songs?
No.
We looked at them as copycats.
We figured they never played any of our songs. We ain't going to play any of their songs.
They stole stuff from us, and that's the way we looked at it, and that was the end of it.
Well, I mean, stole
that's,
stuff.
I know, but that's how we looked at it.
We were
time.
Already playing those songs.
Yep.
For a couple of years before they came along and started playing them.
You're talking about old blues songs.
Yeah. We had already
and Buddy Holly, Not Fade Away. We've been doing Not Fade Away from the day we started.
Yeah.
You know, and Louise, we were convinced that Louise Harrison Caldwell, George Harrison's sister, went back and sold us out.
What's this about?
You don't know about Louise Harrison.
Let's hear.
Bill Deal brought her over. He found her as George Harrison's sister in England.
Yeah.
So he'd bring her over as part of the show, this promotional thing, and she just loved the Underbeats. She just flat out loved the Underbeats. And we were doing songs like Not Fade Away and a bunch of stuff that the Stones covered, coincidentally, 6 months to a year later. So we were convinced that it was a conspiracy. They were coming over to steal our stuff.
And Bill Deal brought George Harrison's sister over here. For
Louise Harrison Caldwell.
We were playing at Dayton's in the auditorium.
I wouldn't really.
They used
to
do a teen thing up there on like Saturday afternoon.
The Beatles thing was at such a fever pitch that you could bring a Beatles shoe that they wore in high school, and you had to have a crowd out front.
So she would show up at Dayton's and do what?
Just go up there and Bill Deal would chit chat. We liked it because we got nice long breaks out of it. Instead of a 15-minute break, they would come up and do this.
So Bill Deal would interview George Harrison's sister on stage?
Yeah.
That's how she got to know the Underbeats.
Yeah, she loved us. She loved us.
George Harrison's sister.
Yeah.
Good Lord, boy, we had a lot of
But I mean, it was the Beatles thing was at such a fever pitch.
It was
that,
unbelievable.
Yeah, that everybody, we were lucky that we
George
got to ride
George Harrison's sister featuring the Underbeats.
I think I lost part of my hearing at 8th Floor Auditorium of Dayton's.
So you guys are pretty much on top of the local scene.
One of us. One of the there's a few of us out there.
Us, the Ivani's and the Accents.
Those were the days when you could actually make a living playing.
Money.
Yeah, we were. But, I mean, a few years later, that kind of all disappeared. Yeah.
The very first gig the Underbeats did was Chisago City. It was me, Don, Russell Hagen, and Duke.
Bob Duane.
And Russell had to use Ray's guitar.
And
how did that happen? And your amp.
And your super.
How did that happen?
Couldn't do the gig.
It was your guitar
New Year's
and your
Eve.
Amp. You should have the answer.
You couldn't do the gig.
But I remember we got $80 for the gig. And after the gig, took photographs.
Talked to Russell.
Russell was holding the $80. Oh, God, it seemed like we were.
I got pictures of it.
I got to talk to
Denny's got them.
We're on top of the world.
So when you guys were at your peak with all these hit 45s on the local radio stations, how much would you gross in a night?
I think it was around 150, 175.
Some nights, you know, depending on where it was, it could go as high as 250. But that was,
but we were
like,
playing every
you're
night
talking
of the
thousands
week,
of dollars in today's
if
money.
We were getting $200, it was like those private parties we played.
Yeah, we played for the governor.
Yeah, we do.
Governor's daughter.
I think you're right.
About
a buck and a half.
Buck and a half. Because that's all most of the dance hall guys would go.
Yeah.
I remember $25-$30 a piece a night was about.
We played some like fraternity parties. We played.
Oh, the frat parties were big players.
We did some graduation parties.
We
got more money for some of those gigs than
they
we did.
Gave us,
right.
They showed up at Danceland one night. Some guys started waving money out front. Carl Rovog's daughter's having a coming out party. They want you to play. No, we're not interested.
We played for Cal.
We couldn't care less. Well, by the time they got around, they gave us enough money, we did it. And we showed up out there. Jim walks up to the microphone, blop. Remember that 2-foot arc?
Oh, yeah.
And just about killed them. But we played for the Coles family, for their daughter's coming out party.
I had
home the Star and Tribune. Just private deal. Private deal. They came up and offered us the money.
How about the Wacota Arena?
Oh, yeah.
Play there. Nice. Cow Palace.
Yeah. Cow Palace?
Didn't they call it the Cow Palace?
Yeah.
Down by that was actually an Ice Palace.
Right, Cow Palace. It was a hockey rink.
Underneath the floor was ice, and they put wooden pallets on top of it to have dances.
Yep.
So you could like see your breath when you were setting up your equipment.
Ruined it. But it was okay later.
People just got lost.
Remember the Lion's Den?
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Where was the Lion's Den?
That was in St. Paul. It was over in that same area.
Yeah.
Oh, Mr. Lucky's.
Yeah. Yeah.
I can never understand why they would change the name of a place from Mr. Lucky's
to Magoo's.
Yeah.
They were two separate places.
They were.
And then they ended up folding it, Mr. Lucky's Inn, to Magoo's.
Yeah, maybe right.
Mr. Lucky's was just a cool name.
Yeah, it was a great place to play.
Definitely a hot spot place.
Oh, man, that's where we got to know the Ravon. First time I saw Robbie and the Ravons. I mean, we're buddies with these guys to this day. But I heard them, Jim said, these guys are pretty good. Yeah, they are. 14-year-old kid playing bass, and we saw him down at Mr. Lucky's.
Who's that?
I morphed into Crow eventually.
Yeah,
Larry.
Robbie and the Ravons.
You're talking about Larry?
Larry and Dick
Wiggins. Well, they were the Ravons when they first started. We played with these guys out in Bloomington. Yeah, Lonnie Knight. There was Dick Wiggins, Larry Wiggins, and Harry Neal.
So what year do you get drafted, Jim?
1966, September.
Okay, so you take...
Don Johnson.
So you're gone. Who fills in for you?
Wally Walstead on the guitar.
Where was he from?
From Wilmer.
How did you find him?
When we were rehearsing one time, we had a place at the Ritz Theater that was our rehearsal studio.
Where was the Ritz Theater?
Northeast Minneapolis.
Still there.
But Wally came in one day, and this boy could play some jazz. I mean, geez, I mean, this guy was just all over. I mean, it was an amazing guitar, but I couldn't believe it. But some reason he thought I was great because I could play Chuck Berry. So we kind of locked and we traded some things. I'd show him a little Chuck Berry. He'd show me a little bit of it, you know, of his thing like that. So we got to be good friends. So when I got drafted, the problem was we needed someone who could also sing, a guitar player who could sing. And that wasn't just happening. So Wally could play the guitar, but James Walsh, who's a keyboard player, played organ with the Hot Half Dozen.
Yep.
He was an excellent singer. Organs at that time gave me a headache.
Farfisa.
It was usually the Farfisa guys or the Hammond guys would just lay on that note until it just but anyway, Walsh played decent organ and he just sang great. So I thought, well, okay, these two guys until I get home. The thing is, I really didn't plan on going to Vietnam and being in the infantry. So these guys really didn't think I was coming home, but I surprised everybody.
I told and you I when
made
you left
it.
You
I would. Made it. So the deal was when he gets back, then his Jim is back at the band and y'all hit the road. So the thing is, when I got back, I didn't need a guitar player, but I still liked Owl, this Walsh. I liked his voice and I just, the way he played seemed to fit the band real nice. So I thought, what the hell?
Okay.
So I kept Walsh in the band and I came back and Wally went his way.
Had the band changed?
Oh, yeah.
How?
I was gone.
Rob was gone, Ray was gone.
What was the, tell me the new lineup.
The new lineup was Tom Nystrom.
From the Accents.
Drummers, from the Accents. And that was from before I went in. Don was still playing bass. Enrico Rosenbaum playing rhythm guitar and singing. And me, that would have been, it would have been a four-piece band. But then Owl made it a five-piece band. Walsh.
Had you seen Enrico in the Escapades?
Yeah, that's when I got him out of there right away. We need this guy. I'm sorry, Ray.
Vocalist.
I was leaving.
This guy was just the killer. He was the killer in town.
Because
the women
singing.
Just loved him. He could sing, and he just had a great attitude. And he's just playing, sing. Just he's a very talented guy.
Was he wearing a wig at the time?
Yep.
They all were.
Yep.
This was Ron Butwin. Yeah,
Ron Butwin. Mm-hmm. I talked to Ron. He calls every other week, so I still talk with Ron Butwin. This guy's hilarious.
Were the Escapades pulling off a little scam trying to...
Yeah, and Zippy was playing guitar with them.
What was the scam?
Tom Kaplan.
They thought they could push themselves off as English.
And they were doing it. That's why I got Rico out of there right away.
But you figured it out. They were not
immediately.
No.
The talent in the band
to me was Enrico.
Yep.
Enrico Rosenbaum. I mean, Zippy's very talented guitar player, but I didn't need a guitar player.
Did the non-musicians... believe they were a British band?
I don't think so.
No.
Everybody knew they were local.
Yeah. They never fooled themselves.
Okay. So it was just a...
And her wig started going bad, too.
I'm pretty honest around here.
So it was a gimmick.
With the wig thing. Thing.
Fever pitch.
It was a good gimmick.
Right, the wig. Yeah.
Nobody knew the wig thing except the musicians.
Yeah.
I don't think the crowds back then really cared. They didn't know the difference between us and the English bands.
They wanted to dance. No, they didn't drink. If they drank, they brought their own bottle. Because there was no drinking. It was all teenage dances.
Right. When did it change from teenage dances to concerts?
L.A.
Oh, Jesus. Yeah. When we turned into Gypsy, when we went to Los Angeles.
But I mean,
1969.
I mean, in Minneapolis.
I don't know. I was in another country.
It wasn't going on when we left. It was when we got back, but it wasn't going on when we
I don't. You know, when I got back, I came home in 1968 in September. Came back in the van. And the only bar that we played was a place called More Downstairs.
Yeah.
Downtown. And that was a bar. Well, and I'm thinking, we never played bars when I left.
You did some gigs with us.
So that all happened between 66 and 68. I'd say about 1967 is when the band started going into bars. Mm-hmm. I think that is mainly because guys started turning 21. Because we were all under 21.
Bar owners hated us. They didn't like rock and roll.
Oh, hell no.
What did they want?
Whatever they could do to get people in there drinking, and it was usually
Minnesota's polka
music and swing music and stuff like that. Country was big.
Silver Dollar was a big club. Yeah. Back.
So in the second half of the 1960s, when you get back from the war, the local bands had changed, right, Jim?
I got out of the Army in September of 68, and we were in Los Angeles by Thanksgiving.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm. But I mean, in town, there was a second wave of bands. The Steel Roving, The Litter,
right.
Joker's Wild.
Right. Mm-hmm. I have no idea what happened with them.
He missed
it. I mean, I was gone for 2 years. When I came back, we left for Los Angeles.
So when you come back and rejoin the Underbeats, were things just like the old days?
They were very different.
How?
I was no longer the leader.
Who was the leader?
Rico and our manager, Steve Freeman.
Where'd Steve come from?
I got no idea.
Freeman Lighting?
Yes, him and Rico locked up. When I got back from Vietnam, I was just tickled to be alive. I lost a lot of my leader qualities. As far as leading a band, I was just happy to be there. So when I came back, I just went along with the program pretty much.
Freeman promised us, and he did it.
He promised us a record deal within a year in Los Angeles.
Right.
A major record deal with a double album. We were the second ones ever to do a double album. The first ones were Chicago, and then us. The only two that done albums, double albums at that time.
Who was the driving force to go out to Los Angeles?
I was going there one way or another. I mean, once I'd seen what it's like to be out of Minnesota without a winter, I wasn't about to spend.
We had talked about it for 5 years. Yeah, before we were ready to go into service.
Right about the time that I got drafted, we had already, pretty much made plans.
Called making it.
Calling Sonny Curtis and, making the call.
So in order to make it...
You had to go to Los Angeles, New York, and that's it. In Los Angeles, because it's warmer, that's it. We're going to L.A.
And all the time that I lived in Los Angeles, I never contacted Sonny Curtis. I don't know what the hell was wrong. Why did I never... At least it's just a call and say hi.
He turned into a pretty big producer.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah, he sure did. Well,
and you take off.
Yep, in the school bus.
I was driving it.
And you get to Los Angeles, and you're still the Underbeats.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Culture shock?
Oh, boy. Yeah, for me it was.
I'd say more so for them than me, because I had already been used to seeing what it's like not having snow in November. I had already been through a couple of years of that.
Donnie, what's your first impression of Los Angeles?
Well,
the valley.
Golly,
The valley is
Sunset
pool.
Strip. Going down Sunset Strip, seeing all the big billboards. We're driving around in a school bus that says, "Bust Me," with all the signs on it and stuff. And it was just like, it was culture shock.
We asked directions once. I remember one of the first times we were driving on Sunset Strip, and we had a booking at Gazzari's. So we wanted to find out where the place was so we could scope it out the night before. So we're riding along in the bus, and we pull alongside this car. It's like maybe 64 Cadillac out back, and we rolled down the way. Hey, it was a lady, right? She said, "Could you tell us where Gazzari's is?" Turns up it's Beaver's mother.
June Cleaver?
Yes. Couldn't believe it. So, oh, that's right down the street. She was just the sweetest thing. And we all looked at each other like, wow, that was Beaver's mom.
So I'm saying that, you know, we are just like, oh, wow.
Starstruck?
Starstruck.
Oh, totally.
He sees Rich Little walking in front of the club. He says, look, it's Little Richard. Rich Little just about fell over, dying, laughing. And it was like.
I could not
do that.
Your first jobs are at Gazzari's?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about that place.
Okay. First of all, they have closed circuit television, so the dancers can watch themselves while they're dancing. And you're playing. There's three bands a night. You play 1 hour on, 2 hours off, then another on. You play two sets a night, in other words. But there's three bands going all the time. And Bill Gazzari was just a great guy. And his wife, too, Rose. Mm-hmm. She's just a wonderful lady. And they love the rock and roll bands. And the people that got themselves started at Gazzari's are like The Doors, Johnny Rivers. You know, a lot of famous people started at Gazzari's, and you moved down the street to the Whiskey. Okay.
So in a way, it was like American Bandstand?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Except more high tech?
Yeah. But I'll tell you, and the kids that danced there, boy, they were like stars, too. These kids could dance. I mean, they were like the regulars that went there.
Oh, yeah, and they had Hollywood. Yeah, a lot of Hollywood types thing. Would come yeah. in there.
So they would dance knowing they were on...
On TV, and boy, profiling. They just go for it. Oh, yeah.
So what kind of music are the Underbeats playing in Los Angeles?
Heavy harmonies.
I'd say from Buffalo Springfield, Electric Flag, Motown. But it was like nothing they were playing out there.
Really? You were different.
Yeah. And we remained that way. It was just like we were awkwardly... Unique.
Yeah, four lead singers.
Yeah, just stubbornly unique.
Four lead
unique.
Singers, and they all sang together yeah. perfect harmony. That's the whole thing. Is that's what it got yeah. everybody's attention was the way these guys could sing together. That's what got yeah. all the people coming in to hear them. They're just like, wow, there's a wall of sound like you'd hear from Phil Spector.
Between Tom, live. Rico, Walsh, and myself.
Yeah.
I mean,
so you get a
any
following?
One of us could lead yeah. a band.
So you get a following at Gazzari's?
Yeah. And they started calling us. Remember what they started calling us?
The Hip Four Freshmen?
No, the Groovy People.
Because you know. They didn't like the Underbeats. So they started calling
yeah,
us the Groovy
but yeah,
People. Forgot
that'll look
it.
Good on a record.
Being from the Midwest, did you stick out in Los Angeles as being
oh,
different?
Oh, totally.
I didn't. I just faded into the woodwork.
We were definitely different. But that made us... Pretty yeah. popular.
What year did the band change the name to Gypsy?
69.
Who came up with the name Gypsy?
Donald Larson.
And the reason was?
Because it fit.
It just seemed like it fit.
Do you have a favorite Underbeat memory, Rod?
We had some great times on the road. One of my favorite places was always Danceland, especially when we were playing there with like another band. Because we'd play our set, and then we'd all go over to the park across the road.
Yeah,
and ride the roller coaster and stuff, yeah, and then run back over and play another set.
I think mine is Mankato meeting the Everly Brothers.
Yeah.
And I never seen guys work this hard on stage in my life. And these guys, at the age, you would think, when you're 23, 34 seems pretty old.
Yep.
But these guys were like kids. And God, they just worked their asses off so hard, and they sang so good. It was amazing.
I always had a nice show.
So Donnie, playing live for you was the big event?
Oh, yeah. Everything else was secondary to playing the music live. And when you'd come off the stage and see that everybody in the audience was having as good a time as we were having, and we got paid.
Guys, thanks for taking the time to go
over
the
story. You're
welcome. You're welcome.
You're totally welcome. Good,
hope you can edit all this stuff out. Somebody's going to be busy.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for the CD.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for the ice cream cone.
Yeah.